So what we discussed, we started discussing SUQ asymmetric annular series with Machiral superfield phi in adjoint representation. And what we showed that there is a moduli space. There is a moduli space, space of vector. So this moduli space is a solution to the determining equation. And so one way how we can actually parameterize this moduli space is by introducing h invariant coordinate q. So if we do that, what we have at low energies, we have n equal 1 vector superfield, right? So just a u1. N equal 1 vector superfield. Just a photon, and then we have a neutral, chiral superfield, neutral chiral superfield. So solving this model was so we have a low energy effective action of the moduli space, and so this low energy effective action. The only non-trivial information in this low energy effective action is that U1 coupling, which can depend on exactly where we are in the moduli space. So this tau of U is theta of 2 pi plus I of 4 pi squared. And so what we discussed yesterday is that if we start, so this is G squared, right? Of SU2. So if we start with SU2 gauge theory, so this SU2 gauge theory is strongly coupled, so there will be a strong coupling scale lambda. And so so if we are sitting somewhere on this moduli space at some point u, so speaking, I have to have a unit, so this is lambda squared, this is the absolute value. Lambda, so this is a scale mu. So what happens is that precisely at that point, what we're doing, we're Higgsing our SU2. So SU2 is broken to a U1 by the non-zero lab of that adjoint Higgs field. And exactly at this value, the U1 coupling is fixed. So this is G squared. And so it doesn't drop. And so then, just based on our holomorphy, we wrote what do we expect? What do we expect how our gauge coupling look like? Well, there is a classical value. This is SU2 classical coupling plus plus there is a one Lucranic, which is given by this law, ln lambda to the fourth over u squared, plus there is a series, of instant non-corrections, which is again lambda to the fourth over u squared power n. So that was our expectation. How does the coupling of a u1 changes as we move in the modular space? And what we discussed where we finished last time is that there were two puzzles. So one puzzle was that so we start with n equal to superpotential, which is equal to zero in this case. And so if we deform this superpotential by introducing a mass term for the adjoint Higgs field, so a mass term of this type. So what we know is that it's happening, then the n equal 2 SUSY is broken to n equal 1 SUSY. And so we know that this n equal 1 supersymmetric field theory must confine. So must not have modulate spacing. And there is no way how we can describe this process given the effective degrees of freedom of the moduli space we have. So we cannot describe this. Cannot describe this in our effective fields. So in fact, what we get something completely stupid. Right? So what we will get is, so once we add this type of a superpotential, we can use non-randomization theory. And so this tells us that if we deform this microscopically, in our effective field theory, the potential will take this form. It will be mu. And so what we have that there is an F-term equation. Del W over del U equals to M, and we can never make it equal to zero. So there is, the moduli space is completely lifted, okay? And that's a contradiction with the expectation, in particular with the weakening. We expect that there should be two isolated vacua left, right? So this is F terms from deformation. And so what we see that they actually leave the whole moduli space. Okay? So that's why this is what I mean here by making a statement. So that our effective field theory, the one we understand it, cannot describe properly this breaking. And the second problem is that tau of u, if we think of this as a holomorphic function, it has harmonic real and imaginary parts, and they are unbounded. And so tau of u has an unbounded imaginary part, and so that implies breaking of the unitary. And so given that, one possible assumption is that, well, we can, you know, put our heads down, or we can try to look as a hint, look at the things and see what's happening. And so in particular, what we would like to do is to make a guess as to missing degrees of freedom that we need to include in our effective field theory. And then once we include this missing degrees of freedom, we have to pretty much reanalyze the whole effective description and see whether those puzzles are resolved. That's exactly what Zeigler and Newton did in his construction. So the missing degrees of freedom are actually monopoles. And so before we will continue in discussing this, I'm just going to give you a crash course on monopoles. And in fact, so there will be two ingredients how we resolve these two puzzles. So there will be one ingredient, which is monopole, and the other very important ingredient is the notion of electromagnetic duality in phase space. Electromagnetic duality. And so I need to explain you these two basic things before we can actually go back to the model and resolve the puzzles. So let's start with monopoles first. So before I go ahead, is the logic clear? Is it clear what we are trying to do? Okay. So monopoles, now we again forget about the supersymmetry. And so we consider magnetic charge. In electromagnetism, right? So, and once we have a magnetic charge, there will be a magnetic field, okay, associated with this charge. If I call charge Q, then there will be a magnetic field of this type, or pi r squared. And I can measure how big is my magnetic field by actually evaluating an integral. infinity, so this is S here infinity. If I have some complicated configuration, so if I evaluate this integral, so it will give me what's the magnetic charge. What is my magnetic charge? Now, if I want to construct a quantum field theory which contains monopoles, I need to actually realize magnetic fields of this type in terms of gauge potentials. And so in quantum field series, we need to introduce a mu, a vector potential. And so we need to introduce a vector potential in such a way that our magnetic field due to the monopole will be grad cross A, where A is a vector potential corresponding to a monopole. And the point is that it is not possible to find a precisely of this type, vector potential of this type, which is non-singular. Which is not singular everywhere except the origin, right? So we don't have a problem of having potentials being singular at the origin because we have all the sources there, and so we're assuming that we have a monopole there. However, it turns out that we cannot do it in a way which is non-singular everywhere, except for a source. So we cannot do it with a single gauge potential, but we can do it if we allow ourselves to have several vector potentials. So the solution is allow for several gauge vector potentials. So explicitly, for the examples that I said, so what we can do, we can imagine that I have a sphere, right? Should be able to imagine the sphere. The important thing is that so I cut the sphere into two hemispheres. So there is the north hemisphere and there is a south hemisphere. So this is r equal to zero. This is r equal to zero. That's the origin. That's where my monopole sits. And I want to find out what the vector potential is. In this case, that would correspond to a magnetic field of the monopole sitting at the origin. As I told you, I cannot set it up when I have a single potential, but I can do it with two different potentials. So setting up a vector potential on the northern hemisphere separate, and a vector potential on the south hemisphere separate. So this is a vector, so let me explain you how am I going to describe this vector. So on the sphere, I have two Euler angles, right? So one of them is the theta. One of them is the theta angle, right? And corresponding to this theta, there is a unit frame vector in theta. And then there is another vector, which I cannot draw in my picture, but you can imagine it, it's the vector corresponding to the phi rotation, right? So there are these two basis vectors on the field. And so I can write down the vector potentials in this way. So I have qm over 4 pi r, 1 minus cosine theta, sine theta, and then here I have e phi. So my vector potential is completely aligned along this e phi vector, unit frame vector. And on the south hemisphere, I have a vector potential of this type, 1 plus cosine theta, divided by sine theta, and then I have phi hat as well.
So it turns out that if you do that,
so those are well-defined vector potentials. So I have to think of this, that these guys in the northern hemisphere, so and these guys in the southern hemisphere, pi over 2 to pi, so they're well-defined everywhere except at the origin. And if I actually compute using the magnetic field, then I will find out that the magnetic field generated by those potentials precisely the magnetic field of a monopole at the origin. So those guys produce B vector of that. That's all good, but the question is how can we make sense of introducing two-gauge potential? In fact, there is an algorithm. So AN and AS overlap. So there is a single, there is a lower dimensional manifold, which in this case is a circle, at which they overlap, and that theta equals pi over 2. So along that circle, what I can do, I can ask the question, how much my vector potentials differ. And so what I will find out, that A north minus A south on that circle equals to a gradient of chi. And this chi equals over 2 pi times pi. So what we showed that even though in order to describe the magnetic field due to monopole, we need two vector potentials. So they are defined in different patches on our sphere. And in the overlap, the place where two patches overlap, northern and southern hemisphere overlap, that's an equator. So it turns out that the difference between them is just a gauge transformation. That's a well-defined that's a well-defined setup. However, following Dirac, we can actually ask the question: what will happen if we try to quantize our fields in the presence of magnetic monopole? So one thing that we notice is that this function, right? So basically, this is a gauge function. So it's defined at theta equals pi over 2 and at angle phi, right? So our manifold is compact, right? And phi plus 2 pi is exactly the same as phi. However, my gauge transformation, phi plus 2 pi, is not equal to chi of phi. So the price that we pay is that our gauge transformation that we do is not continuous, right? So if those two numbers were the same, then we'd have a nice well-defined continuous gauge transformation. But gauge transformations that we need to describe the monopole field is discontinuous. Gauge transformation to describe or better to say to patch to page. And S is discontinuous.
Does it check the exponential offset when it's not discontinuous?
It is. So the actual U1 gauge is continuous. I mean, shouldn't they?
So this is a gauge transformation, right? So everything.
Yeah, when a gauge transformation is.
I'm on the sphere. Why would I expect? So when I do, so you're gonna tell me that somehow my function behaves like.
I'm going to tell you that you have a gauge potential. Well, you have a gauge function G in your U1 group.
Yeah.
Which is basically e to the i, whatever in this case is e to the i phi. and that is perfectly periodic. It's,
no,
it's,
I don't
just, it's just
I,
that you
I,
have
I,
kind
I,
of
the vector potential transforms in this way, right? The first transformation is vector, that's the way how it transforms.
Yeah, but if you write on the group element,
I'm asking, see, this vector potential, I'm asking the question. I'm sitting in this point in space-time. I want my vector potential to be single valued. If you wish, is it single valued? And the statement is that it will not be single valued. Well, for that reason, if I want to describe it in terms of all single valued functions. So all I have to do, I have to go around the equator, come back to that point, right?
Yeah.
And my gauge function will be different, right? So
yeah, your gauge function will be different. But if you consider the U1 group element,
yeah,
which corresponds to your gauge function, that will not be discontinuous because I think isn't there a constraint
no,
that you have
right,
some?
So we'll need this. So delta pi, the change is going to be equal to Qm, right? Now, as far as we can see, Qm is 1 over root 2.
Okay.
We have no idea what Qm is. I mean, it's just an arbitrary. I told you there is this field in electrodynamics. There is this magnetic field that I want to describe. I didn't tell you that Qm, where does, so that's exactly where I am heading, the quantization condition for the monopole charge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's along the lines that you are suggesting, that's the way how we're going to quantize. But as it is right now, it is any number. And so we have a discontinuity. First of all, what you say, I don't quite understand, because even if that would happen to be 1, right, I would still say that I don't have a well-defined electromagnetism, because my gauge function is not, I'm sitting in the same point in space-time, and it takes different values. Okay. But you will be happy, because eventually, I made you happy with saying that it can be 1 over root 2, right? Then your argument, whatever the argument you have, is not supposed to work. At this stage, again, my point is that at this stage, we don't know the value of Qf. It can be any number. Okay. So in fact, you will see that the Dirac quantization condition will determine for us that number. It can be fractional. It depends how we quantize our electric charges. So for example, that, I wanted to give an example of quarks, but that's a bad example because for quarks or for fractional, so for one such like charges, the magnetic charge will end up quantizing. We'll see in a second. So for now, we have this puzzle that as we go around, delta phi changes. And so what Matt was alluding to is that, what does that mean? And so what that means on a rigorous level, suppose I have a wave function of a boson that is defined at each point on the space-time. And so let's suppose that this is a wave function of a bosonic state of charge QE. Again, I'm not telling you how I am quantizing it, I'm just telling you that it has some charge QE. So I know that if I do any gauge transformation, then my wave function will get changed, and it will get changed as e to the minus IQE, and then I have my gauge parameter, right? Times what I had before, right? So if I go around on an equator, what will happen is that my gauge transformation is discontinuous. So as I go around, this will go to e to the minus I QE QM over 2 pi times 2 pi psi of S and T, right? And so in particular, what we see is that my wave function, again, I'm looking at the bosonic state, will develop this additional phase. On the other hand, we know that once what we did from the spatial perspective, we just did a full rotation, right? And so the wave function must not change. So it must be exactly the same as the wave function we started with. And so that tells us, that puts us constraints, what are the possible charges of magnetic monopoles if we have some electrically charged objects in our so it's 2 pi, 2 pi n, where n is an integer number. Right. So it's not exactly 1 over root 2, but it's 2 pi or something. Okay, very good. So this is actually a well-known Dirac quantization condition, which tells you if you have a U1, what is an allowed set of electric and magnetic charges on the U1 if you want to make our quantum mechanics consistent. This is Dirac. Okay. So any questions?
Yes. So now, if you write out del chi as del of your gauge transformation of your quantum field divided by that gauge transformation, which is the same as del chi, then you see that everything is continuous. It's only the representation of, well, the way how you write it down by kind of abbreviating to the proper gauge transformation, which makes it.
Well, right. So no, I still don't. Well,
the actual gauge transformation itself, right, is perfectly continuous. I mean, that's just why you get the quantization condition. It's only the way you write it down in an abbreviated form for. Electromagnetism, it makes it look discontinuous.
That's correct. I guess what you are saying is that I was looking only, well, but that's exactly what I did. If I look,
if I look only
on the vector potential, then I don't see any.
Yeah, but that's only because people because get the proper gauge transformation. Proper gauge transformation is g times del g minus 1.
Yeah.
And G and G to the minus 1 are perfectly continuous, which is why.
Right, so you can say that, right, so I see, so in some sense, I see what you're saying. You're saying that somehow I choose to look at the Lie algebra element of the gauge group.
Yeah.
And in fact, if I would look at the a group element, then I could do the quantization in that way. Yeah. Which is exactly, in some sense, that's exactly what. I don't understand this. You know what you are saying. So what's the group element? Right? So the group element would be e to the I delta chi, right? Delta chi is qm. So you're gonna tell me that e to the I qm, right, should be equal. What is this? You want to put it to identity? So then you get the quantization that QM equals 2 pi, 2 pi m.
Okay, there's missing a factor of QE then.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I that's why I don't understand your argument.
The correct argument is actually looking at the states in the theory,
and that's what we did. We look at the wave function of a boson, and we know. If we want to write down a consistent quantum mechanics, what will happen with that wave function? And if it is charged, we also know how to transform.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this get rid of the problem of most values of the vector potential?
It doesn't. It simply tells you that not all values of QE and QM are allowed if you impose quantum mechanics. So you can still leave with that.
But so is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's okay. In fact, when we talk, so if you think what's happening is that there is a manifold, and on that manifold we construct a vector function. So our manifold is a sphere. So it turns out that if we want to construct a vector function which would correspond to a magnetic field of a monopole, we cannot construct it everywhere on the sphere. Yeah. We need to construct it on the patches. So that's a well-defined notion of pretty much, you know, that's what fiber bundle is. So in this case, it's a simple vector field that we are constructing, and we are finding in the language of fiber bundles, we are finding a transformation functions, or if you wish, maps, if we go from one patch to another. In that case, going from one patch to another is going looking what happens at the equator. Okay, and see, as itself, you know, this is something that, you know, I guess Matt had in mind as well. I mean, this gauge function, it's unobservable. So we need to ask a physical question. So so the claim is that there is no way, yeah, it is discontinuous, but the question is, do we care? When do we have to care about this? Okay. So one thing is that if I don't have electrically charged objects in my theory, right, then, you know, monopoles of arbitrary charge are allowed. Right? So there is, I don't have this quantization. It becomes sensible question only if I have electric and magnetic states. And that's where we will have to know. So what we're going to do now, we're going to construct. So at this stage, it was pretty abstract. And then you can ask, OK, so that's all very good. But can we actually construct, much like in the case of instanton, I have been able to write down an explicit configuration corresponding to an instant field. Is there a configuration, a classical configuration in quantum field theory that I can write down that will carry a magnetic charge? And the answer to that question is yes. And so that's, I'm not going to do the construction in details, but this is known as a hooped particle monopole. But I'm going to give you the essential features, okay? And I will explain you what's going on there. So the model that we're going to look at is actually surprisingly similar to the model that you can see there. So the model doesn't have any supersymmetry now. We have n equals 0 is 2c. And so our Lagrangian is minus 1 over 4 g squared f mu a, f mu a. So those are su2, our field stress, right? So this is exactly what we have. And then I have a scalar field, d mu phi a, d mu phi a, and then minus a potential. Okay, so this is our a joint field. So we can think, right, so I guess, you know, for this purpose, we can think about this a real real field, real scalar Higgs. Higgs in adjoint representation. Okay, so what we have is similar, but not exactly that. We have a complex Higgs field in adjoint representation, and we don't have a potential. Let's pretend that that's what we have. Let's do something. So this is a Cadarion derivative, so this guy is charged. Let's forget about the gauge set for now. Okay. So let's look just let's look just at this model. So what I'm going to show you now, I'm going to show you. First, I give you a physical idea of what the monopole field is, and then I'm going to prove to you that in order to have a monopole, we need non-Abelian gauge fields. Without a non-Abelian gauge group, we cannot have something non-trivial that would be interpretable as a monopole later. And that's known as Derek's theorem, something like that. So, in order for me to proceed, I need to specify what the potential is. So I want to insist, eventually, I want to make my potential to be a gauge invariant. So I'm just going to write down my potential in this way, sum over a, b, a, b, a, minus b squared. I'm just going to write it down in this form. So where a, so it's an adjoint representation, so the index a runs from 1 to 3. Okay. Now, Now, if I ask the question, where does my vacuum is, right? So my vacuum is when the absolute value phi a squared, right? So I mean the sum here equals to b squared. So this is a condition that I sit in a vacuum. But then there are various ways how I can have a vacuum, right? So I can have a vacuum. So this is a field, right? So phi a, suppose I look only at the static configurations. So let's look at static configuration only. So if we look only at static configuration, so our field can depend on a space-time. And so if I want to choose a vacuum, so one way how I can do it, I can actually set make our field homogeneous and say that it doesn't matter where in the space-time I am, the field gets the same value. Okay? So what I'm doing is the following. So again, now we are talking about topologically distinct maps, and so let me explain you the maps that I'm gonna talk about. So as will be clear in a second, the relevant questions we're gonna ask, what is the field configuration as r goes to infinity, right? As we look infinitely far away. And so as we go infinitely far away, so we already remember that our space-time asymptotically is S2, right? So there is a two-sphere. So this is spatial at r equals infinity, right? So at infinity we have a two-sphere. Now what we have this condition in the field space. Right, and this condition in the field space is, as you can see, so it defines S2 as well. So what we have when we choose a vacuum. So what I want to look now at interesting configurations in which my field is not constant. Okay. But I want to have a finite energy. I'm asking the question, when do I have a finite energy? And so in order for me to have a finite energy, so as absolute value of x goes to infinity, phi of x must go to b squared. And what I'm telling you is that as x goes to infinity on the spatial part, in space, we have an S2, and in the Higgs space, we have also S2. And so what we have a map from the Higgs space, right? So configuration space. Space of Higgs field. And into a sphere at infinity. So this is our phi a, sum a equals b squared, and this is our sphere at infinity. So we have a metric d squared equals to dr squared plus r squared on d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. So asymptotically, we have a sphere. And so what we see that in order to have a finite energy in our configuration, so what we need to do, we need to specify a map from this sphere into this sphere. So the map that I discussed before is when I choose a particular point, so actually we sort of go the other way around. By choosing a point on an asymptotic sphere, we are asking what is the value of the Higgs field there. So our maps go this way. And so the point is that In the simplest configuration, when I say that the var of pi sub a equal to b, so it's all the same. Well, this is a vector, so I guess I'm. So if I have a configuration of this type, then actually all this spatial sphere is mapped into a north pole in the Higgs case, on the Higgs sphere, right? So it's a trivial map. And so is it clear? Clear enough. So monopoles are configurations. So what will end up to be a monopole? Monopoles are going to be non-trivial. Non-trivial maps from say S2 to S2. So maps from here, maps which have a non-zero winding number or wrapping number in this case. And so from this, it's clear that the configurations that we're going to talk about will be characterized by an integer n, right, a wrapping number of the map. So let's try to, so even though there are these interesting configurations that in principle we can construct just based on topological arguments, what I'm going to show to you is that any such configuration will actually have an infinite energy. Because it will have an infinite energy, then we just cannot have it. So we cannot have these interesting windings of the Higgs field at infinity in order to produce something not trivial. So show that all configurations has energy equal to infinity. Well, the way how we can do this is actually very straightforward. We're just going to construct a Hamiltonian corresponding to this gauge theory. In this case, it's not a gauge theory, it's just a single scalar field with SU2 global symmetry, and it's in the adjoint versus SU2. So the Hamiltonian will take this form. So I have a time derivative of the field, right? So there will be one term like that. Then there will be a contribution. There will be a gradient contribution will also come with a plus sign, this will be a gradient piece. And then there is a potential, right? So clearly the energy that we talk about, so first of all, we talk about static configurations. So we don't care about time derivatives. So let's look. So there is a potential term, and so at infinity there will be no contribution. But in principle, as we integrate over the whole ball, there can be a contribution. I don't worry about that now. In fact, in order for me to show that it's infinity, it will be enough. It will be enough to look at this gradient term. So let's look at this gradient term. So I have an integral over d3x. So the integral d3x, if I go asymptotically, so I have r squared dr, and then there will be an integral over coordinates on the two sphere, right? So the important thing for me is that there is a scaling r squared dr. Now, if I write down the gradient, I can write down the gradient in polar coordinates, the ones that I wrote there,
And so it will be del phi over del r squared, right? And then there will be derivatives. There will be derivatives with respect to theta and pi angle. So let me look just at the derivative with respect to theta. Okay. Now, as you can see, that I actually made a mistake by writing it down this way. So it will be multiplied by r squared. The reason for that is that when I write down here, what I mean is that it's del I phi, del j phi, and then I have to multiply it by the inverse metric, gij. So I made a mistake. So it's going to be one over r squared, right? Because in gij here, at least corresponding to this d theta piece is r squared. So the inverse method one over r squared. And so now, if we look at some of these winding configurations, for a winding configuration, del phi over del theta as r goes to infinity is not equal to zero, right? So because so my field winds as I go around the asymptotic sphere, and so it's just not zero. So what this tells me is it tells me that asymptotically for a winding configuration, this gradient term will be four to one over r squared. But if they are 4 to 1 over r squared, then the integral, this integral r squared dr, 1 over r squared, will diverge. So this just completes the proof. Of course, you know, we can look in the original literature, and the reference is in the textbook by Chen and Li. You can look in the section on monopoles. There is a reference to the original paper by Derek, where he actually proves it. I don't think it's much more than what I said here. But basically what we showed that for any of such winding considerations, energy will differ. So we cannot have interesting finite energy configurations. So the statement is that story changes once we include the gauge field. And the reason why the story changes is because now I don't have simple del mu phi in my action, but del mu phi is changed to a covariant derivative, and this covariant derivative actually contains gauge field, and so it will contain a mu. And so it is possible, and this is what was shown in a paper by Proust and Poliakov. Again, you know, I can give you the original reference, but I think that, so I looked at the original reference quite a long time ago, but I don't think it's so the first step is again looking into the book by Chen and Li, and they nicely give an overview of that construction. So the thing is, so you have a gauge potential, right? So you will have a gauge potential, and so it turns out that that corresponding to this gauge potential, there is a field strength. So first of all, the Truth-Poiliakov monopole is in SU2 gauge theory with Edgeo and Higgs, the model that we started discussing there. And so it turns out that once we have this this non-trivial field configuration, the SU2 gauge group is going to be broken to a U1, and that U1 will have a non-zero profile, a non-trivial profile for a magnetic field. And in fact, if we use our formula and compute the charge of that configuration by integrating the magnetic field of this U1
with respect to the over the two sphere at infinity, we will find out that it's equal 4 pi times qm. Where nm is an integer. So the reason why we have this, so you already see a quantization, and it can be shown that the quantization is consistent with the quantization rule that we derive. The reason why we have this quantization is because besides, we need both electric and magnetic states in the theory to have quantization. And the reason why we have an electric state is actually simple. So what we can do, we can, okay. So if I look at simplest configuration, right? So if I look at configurations in which the winding number is zero, right? Or if I put my fixed field into this form 0, 0, d, so it's a constant there everywhere. So in this case, so this is just a standard Higgs phenomena in which SU2 is broken to a U1, and so once it gets broken to a U1, I started with a 3-gauge boson here. So after the breaking to a U1, I will have one photon, a massless field. Photon corresponding to this U1, plus I will have a charged W gauge boson, so I will have W plus and minus, and so this, for example, other states that carry plus and minus charge under this U1, and so this charge QE is plus and minus 1. So, you can ask me, well, okay. If you are not asking me anything, then I will not tell you about the subtlety and go ahead. Any questions? Okay, so you might say, I lied to you. I just tell you that there is a subtlety. I said that the Dirac quantization is correct, but the formula is 4 pi nm. And I told you that the charge of W is plus 1, so that contradicts, the statement is contradicting, but it's fine since I said it. Right, so we see a contradiction, right, between the Dirac quantization condition. The Dirac quantization condition that we derived before was 2 pi m, where m is an integer. And so now I'm telling you that in my theory, there are states which are W plus or minus bosons that come from a standard Higgs mechanism, and those states carry an electric charge plus or minus 1. So my quantization condition must be Qm equals to 2 pi m, but somehow the truth particle monopole that I constructed is twice as big as the charge, right?
What's the problem?
In principle, there is no problem, but then you could say, do we miss something? Right. Is it possible that there are some monopoles, monopole-like configurations that Mr. Hooft and Polyakov did not find? So that would be a nice question to ask. And the answer to that question is no, they found everything. And so then the question is, why does the quantization, so all the monopoles in this theory are the ones that they found, and those states carry the magnetic field corresponding to a magnetic charge 4 pi nm. And the reason for that is that it turns out that in this theory, we can also, this is a bit subtle and I don't want to spend much time on that, but it turns out that in this theory, if I introduce, so we have states only in the adjoint representation, but it is consistent to introduce states in fundamental representation. Uh, of the gauge group. And that's some generalizations of the pure blue series that Seiberg and Witten, for example, do. And so now if you look at these states that were the fundamental representation, after the ordinary Higgsing, those are the states. So if we normalize the W boson charge to be plus or minus one, that's a choice that we can make. But once we make the choice, then we don't have a choice here. Okay, so it turns out that Q electric comes plus or minus 1/2 in that case. And that explains why the quantization, so then the quantization condition is that, because the smallest, so in order to get the small, the right quantization of magnetic charges, you need to substitute the smallest electric charge, and it is 1/2. Okay. So, good. So I told you.
Sure.
Yep.
Sure. How does this work with quarks to get charged at 1/3?
So that's an SU3. SU3 is a more complicated theory. Okay. So what happens is that if we have an unabelian gauge groups of rank larger than rank larger than one, right? So we can see the SU2, which is around rank one. So in those cases, there are more complicated monopole configurations. But roughly speaking, as far as I remember, it's always the case that the monopole is embedded into SU2 sub of the larger gauge. But that doesn't answer your question because. I think in that case, yeah. We will get a different. I guess my naive answer would be that we will get a different compensation for magnetic monopole, for the two polar monopole in SU3. Even if you embed it in the SU3 subject of the process.
All right, guys.
So, so one thing that I need to say more is. Let's see. So we understand that there are various ways how we break non-abelian symmetry with a Higgs web, right? SU2 is broken into a U1. And so the way we do the breaking by describing non-trivial profiles of the Higgs field, in particular this winding number. And the thing that we note is that, if we don't have any winding number, because the winding number is zero, then we have just a standard Higgs mechanism. And so in this standard Higgs mechanism, we have massive states, which are W plus or minus bosons. And so the mass formula in this case is the gauge factor, right? So everything we do classically times the wave times the charge. Okay, so this is the formula for the mass of the W plus and minus. Now, I told you that if you wish, this is the masses of electric states. Now there is another configurations corresponding to non-trivial windings corresponding to monopoles. So this is a monopole state. And so in this case, what you can do, you can actually rigorously prove, and you can look in a textbook. I just don't have time to do this. So there is a formula that tells, so first of all, the claim was that there are finite energy configurations. So those will be a finite mass states in my spectrum. So I can ask the question, what is the mass of this state? And so it turns out that the mass of this state is bounded, and it's bounded by this expression. I guess I have to put absolute value everywhere. And in fact, in particular in the model that we discussed, the Seiberg-Witten model, so there are states
that saturate, that saturates a bomb. So there are exactly, these W bosons exist always classically. So I guess I'm making a statement here is that there are monopole states which mass is exactly given by this expression. Good. It turns out that there are more interesting configurations. So then people, when they have and studied more interesting configuration in this simple looking model, just SU2 gauge theory, SU2 with a giant Higgs. There are also states which are called dions. And so this is the ionic states. Those are the states that carry both electric and magnetic charge. So those are more complicated configurations of the unbroken U1. More complicated configurations. So those are the states which carry electric charge and magnetic charge. Everything in this theory. And so they also have a mass. And so in fact, you can generalize this formula what's known as a BPS bond. Chooses the ionic states, and you will find out that the mass of a dion can never drop below this. Okay, so there is this general expression, but that's an absolute value for a ionic state that carry an electric charge, QE, and a magnetic charge, QF. Now, notice that this formula is actually very generic. So in particular, W plus and minus, so you can recover the mass expression for W plus and minus if you put Qm equal to zero, and you can recover the mass, the saturated expressions for the monopole masses if you put Qe equal to zero. So the reason for that is because the states, so there are very special states, the so-called BPS states, that that saturates a bond. And so it turns out, so first of all, such states only arise in theories with extended supersymmetries, theories like what we discussed. So from the viewpoint we are discussing right now, we just need to make the theory supersymmetric, just add fermions. So if we do that, then we will find out that, and remove the potential, right? So remember that our scalar field had a potential, so we need to set up that potential to zero. Then it turns out that in series like that, there are monopoles and dions, and they are the states which have mass, which is given not by inequality, but precise equality. Moreover, these mass formulas, much like the superpotential is protected against quantum correction. So there is a way of writing those expressions exactly, including all non-perturbative corrections. Okay, so but what I want to do now, I want to discuss further. So for now, I just want to give you an idea is that the dions is a generalization that includes both the electrically charged states, like W plus and minus bosons, and also the monopoles, okay? And there are states which actually carry not only electric or magnetic charges, but states that carry both charges as well. So now I want to generalize this formula even first, okay? And So notice that the series that we started talking about is actually a simpler theory compared to the one that we are familiar with.
by now. So in particular, that theory, I can construct a series that model is a specific example of a U1 gauge theory where the theta angle is set equal to zero. So in other words, there is no term proportional to absolute mu rho lambda, f mu f rho lambda in our Lagrange, right? So this is a term, theta times f dual, right? There is no term of this type. So we can ask, how does everything that we talked about will generalize, provided that we have this non-trivial theta? So you might ask, well, does it really matter? So we already know that the theta term does not affect any equation of motion inside the space, but we know that it affects the equation of motion at infinity, right? So it's just a boundary term. So you might feel that given that so much in the physics of monopoles is determined by mappings at infinity, you might expect that there will be an effect of the theta terms on the masses and on the configurations of monopoles and diams, and that's indeed the case. So it turns out that in the presence of this theta term, the quantization condition that we derive changes. Okay. So we derive the quantization condition for the electric charges, QE times QN equals 2 pi N. So this is correct only when the theta angle equals to zero, and when theta angle is not equal to zero, there are modifications to this expression. And so this modification I discussed in a nice paper by Witten, so this was in physics lattice. This lattice 86, 1979, 23. So it's a very nice paper, very readable. So I advise you to look at the original here. And so it turns out that if V4 of the electric charges, suppose were normalized to be an integer when the theta angle was zero, then if the theta angle is not equal to zero, and in the presence of magnetic monopoles, our electric charge actually takes this form, theta times M magnetic divided by 2 pi. Okay, so that's there. So we still have, okay, so what I said is not quite right. So if I use this modified, if I use Q electric equals to M electric, then my quantization condition would be violated. But the correct, so if you wish, the effective electric charge that my wave function will feel will be this one. So Q electric will then, and the quantization condition will be correct with respect to this modified electric charge. So if that is the case, we can actually generalize these EPS bonds in the presence of theta angles, which is important because ultimately we want to do Cyber-Quinton model, and in that case, the complexified coupling contains both the gauge coupling and the theta, and so if we talk about holomorphic properties, then we must include both of them. So let's see how it changes. So the mass of the diam equal or larger than GV. And then instead of Q electric, I just substitute this. So this is known also as a Witten effect. The Witten effect, which tells you if I have a diam, okay, with charge N, E, and N, M, what would be the electric charges and magnetic charges of my diode? Suppose I have a state N, E, state Q, E equals N, E, and Q, M equals N, M, and the theta angle equals to zero. I can ask the question, what would be the charges of my diode, exactly the same diode, when I make the theta angle is not equal to zero. because the electric charge will get shifted to theta and then voltage to pi, and the magnetic charge stays. Okay, so this shift, this shift of the electric charge of the dionic state is known as a Witten effect, and it's explained in the paper that I mentioned. So now we can use this Witten effect to write down the formula for the dion mass. Theta over pi plus pi over 4 pi over g squared and magnetic. Okay. So where I use the quantization condition, right, and load Qm in terms of the integer and m corresponding to a two square or monopole. So this equals gv, and then notice what I have. I have me plus theta over 2 pi plus pi 4 pi over g squared times nm. And so we have this beautiful expression which complexifies the mass formula. So I have me plus tau and m. Okay. So it is the same tau that we've seen many times before, and it was a little bit obscure why and how it shows up. Well, it wasn't obscure. I mean, it showed up because we needed to quantize properly the theta angle. And it just so happened that exactly the same index by couplings enters into the mass formula for the dionic state after we take into account the Witten effect. Right, good. So that's, I'm done with monopoles. So I have to move to the second aspect. Which is electric and voltage duality. So let me explain you what electric and then we will have all the ingredients to understand the way how Cyberman and Witten resolve the problem. So if I look at Maxwell equation, okay, so I'm writing down the Maxwell equation in the absence of sources. So notice that there is a symmetry in this Maxwell equation, which is known as electromagnetic duality. And so this electric magnetic duality so takes E to B, and B takes to minus E. Okay, and so the equations, the Maxwell equations are actually invariant under these transformations. So if I take electric magnetic duality times electric magnetic duality, so if I act with electric magnetic duality twice, then what will happen is that EB will get back to itself, except with a minus sign. So what this tells us that twice acting with electromagnetic duality is the same as, so this must be the same as charge conjugation. Because if I have electric and magnetic charges, they will couple to potential, but potentials will be between signs as well. And so twice it gives charge conjugation. So we can actually extend it, write it down in terms of the field strength. And it turns out that this, if I write it down in terms of the field strength, then the transformation that I wrote there are the transformations where F mu goes to star. Where star is a Hodge dual. So the Hodge duality that we talked before is actually this electromagnetic duality. Now, normally when we talk about electricity and magnetism, we talk only about electric sources. And so in particular, Maxwell equations take this form. So there is an electric current, but there is no, we do not have any magnetic current. Del mu star F mu equal to zero. So we do not have normally magnetic current. And so so that's why the duality is broken if we introduce only the electric sources. But what I discussed, what we discussed earlier today is that it's natural in the U1 theories that arise after after the Higgs mechanism to have magnetically charged object. And so it's natural to have magnetic sources. And so now we can restore the electromagnetic duality if, in addition to switching E and B, we also screw up the electric and magnetic parts. So what I'm going to show now, all right, guys, how much time you're going to give me? Depending how much time you're going to give me, it's how much. So I can finish in 10 minutes, and I can finish in 25 minutes, but that's pretty much how far I'm willing to go. I don't want to go any further. So I'm gonna assume 25 minutes. Is that okay? Because otherwise I will start cramping too much. 15 minutes over. All right, guys, so what I'm going to do to you now, I'm just going to prove that electromagnetic duality is an exact symmetry in the U1 theory. So if I have three quantum doesn't matter much because the theory is free, but let's add this word, it's a nice word. Three quantum one theory, and so actually this electromagnetic duality is a change of variables. So in free quantum, electromagnetic duality is a change of variables. Is a change of variables in pass integral. So because the value of the integral shouldn't change as a change variable, so that means that it's an exact symmetry of my theory. So how does the proof go? It's actually very simple. So let's do it. So what we're going to do, we're going to consider U1 with complexified coupling, theta over 2 pi plus pi, 4 pi over g squared, right? So I have, because I am going to study electromagnetic duality, and the electromagnetic duality involves walking between the field and its high zero, so it's better that I have both of those guys. And so it turns out that, so this is non-supersymmetric theory. I can write down the action in this case as d4x, and then I have tau over 32 pi I, and then I have f plus I star f squared plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay, so the structure, so if we expand everything and add the Hermitian conjugate, it's exactly the same. You will find out the normal electromagnetic field strength squared term, plus there will be a theta term. So there is no matter field, no sources, just free U1 theory. So the coupling doesn't run, so tau is constant. Okay, so it doesn't change. Now, so normally how I'm gonna write down the pass integral. So the pass integral, I need to integrate over gauge potentials. So I need to integrate over dAu into the IS. But what I can do, I can actually integrate over the field strengths. And I can write down this as a pass integral over f mu. If I do that, then I will include a non-physical configuration which will violate the Gauss law. So I need to impose Bianchi. I need to impose Bianchi identity as additional constraint. So I need to introduce some additional vector field rule that imposes Bianchi identity. As a constraint, and so what I need to modify my action from S to S prime. So what will be this modification of the action? Well, it's actually very simple. So the modification of the action S prime is going to be equal to exactly the actions that we had before. And then there is 1 over 8 pi before x. And then I have v mu, absolute v mu, rho sigma, l mu, overall, f rho sigma. So if I take, if I look for the classical equations of motion, then I will just get, the constraint. So I will get just the conditions that epsilon, so delta S over delta V equals to zero. So that simply will give me mu rho sigma del mu rho sigma equals to zero, which is exactly the Bianchi identity. So one thing one thing I want to point out is that why did I write down 1 over 8 pi? Why did I normalize this in this way? Well, the reason is that we have the Bianchi identity in ordinary electromagnetism because we don't have magnetic sources, right? But this Bianchi identity will be violated in the presence of magnetic sources. And so it turns out that that if I have 1 over 8 pi, if I have, for example, a monopole sitting at the origin, then the Bianchi identity will get changed in this way. So I will have 8 pi, the delta function at the origin, right? And strictly speaking, it could have been the charge. So this is the equation. This is the equation in the presence of a monopole of charge one, and so what we have, if you look, what is happening here is that we couple our vector potential, mu couples, so this coupled 1 over 4 pi tells us that we couple our auxiliary field V to a monopole monopole of charge 1. Right? So that 1 over 8 pi coupling is precisely the coupling necessary for V to be the coupling to your charge one magnetic state. So now, what I can do, so I have a class integral over F mu and V, and what I can do, I can rewrite slightly this additional term. So it turns out that what I can write it down as, so I have 1 over 8 pi, v mu, epsilon, mu mu, rho sigma, del mu, f rho sigma, it's going to be equal to 1 over 8 pi. I can write it down, I can show that I can write it down in this way. And moreover, right. So this F closure, this F. So star F is simply because if I F with this epsilon on this guy, that gives me star F.
And then I have an additional tilde field strength. So this F tilde mu mu is equal to del mu d mu minus del mu d mu. So this was a vector potential, and so this F tilde is a corresponding field strength to this auxiliary vector potential. And so I can write down, so this is a straightforward thing to check. I can actually do one more step and write this down in 1 over 16 pi integral star of F tilde plus pi F tilde, and then multiply F plus I star F. And so I have a term of this type. Now notice that that we have n. So now my action contains F plus I star F squared term plus a term linear in this. Okay? And what I'm saying is that I can do this functional integral the other way around. So pretty much this functional integral, again, I can integrate first. Over du, right? I can again go back and replace the integral over du by the integral over the field strength and add the Bianchi constraint. And then the integration is just completing the squares, so we can do the algebra. And what we will find out is that not over du. So if we integrate over du, then we get back what we started with. But if I integrate over f mu, right, then I will get s tilde d for x, and then I have 1 over 32 pi I. And here I have minus 1 over tau f tilde plus I star f tilde squared. Okay? And so my path integral is going to be equal to d of vu into the I test with. Okay? So again, the steps are, we started with the integral with respect to a mu, and the action that contained this field strength. And then at the end of the day, we rewrote it as a path integral, including a different field strength, a different potential, and the action, which is exactly the same action, except that the coupling is different. Okay? So this is an exact identity, right? So that proves, and this is the identity. This is the identity in which we switched F field with respect to F tilde field. So what we do, we start with a coupling tau and a field strength F mu, and then we ended up with a coupling 1 over tau, and then we ended up with a field strength F tilde mu. So in this here, we had a vector potential A mu, and on this side, we had a mu. So this a mu coupled to electrons of charge one, and so this du so couples to monopoles of charge one. So we really implemented at the level of fast integral electromagnetic duality a statement in which we replace fields that couple to electron and magnetic charge. Okay, so in order, right, so there is a change in the coupling,
And then what happens, if I look now, if I have a state which carry charges ME and MM in the first theory, so because we replace what we call electric and magnetic, then this state in this theory will be interpretable as a state with MM minus ME. Okay, so there is a much like in the electromagnetic duality of Maxwell equations, there is a sign flip associated with charge conjugation, and then the electric and magnetic charges flip over. So this element,
this has been to QED with sources that you actually have to introduce electrons and monopoles to keep this.
So,
so you have two charge fields.
Right, so at this, so you know, the electromagnetic duality will not work with the sources. Well, it's more, it depends. It will work if the sources are non-dynamical. But if the sources are dynamical, then it will not work. So if you wish this electromagnetic duality in ordinary field theories, it only works for non-interacting field theories. Surprisingly, the reason why I'm talking about this is because the supersymmetric models, and in particular the ones that we discussed before, the Cyber-Whitted model, on the moduli space, it's a non-interacting U1. And so for that low energy non-interacting U1, everything that I'm talking about is correct. Okay? So in that theory, these states, right, so is this, as long as those states are massive states, right, so, they don't have any effect on the low energy effective action, right? And so what I do, I actually have to formulate fast integral only over my light fields, which is going to be my vector superfield and a massless neutral chiral superfield. But once I do the transformation of my vector superfield, I can ask the question, I still have these massive states, right? Even though they did not take part in this transformation, how do I reclassify the charges of those fields? And so this is what I mean here. If you have a state of ME and MM, then in the new variables. So what happens is just, if you think I just changed variables in my low energy effective fields here, and I had monopole dyads in that theory. So now what they call monopole there will become an electrically charged state in the theory if I use this change of variable. So that's the way how you have to think about electromagnetic duality. All right, guys, so this thing that I described is known as the S element of the electromagnetic duality. So that's the element in which the coupling changes into minus one over tau. And so notice this is known as a strong weak coupling duality because for weak coupling, tau is infinitely large. So if it's very large here, then it will be very small here. So that's a duality transformation in which strong and weak coupling changes. It doesn't make much difference because, again, the theory is not interacting. So there is another element of duality, which is known as the P element. And so that simply comes from the, it's related to the Witten index, but it's also, so I'm not going to discuss too much, given that I'm actually even running out of the time that I said I will take. But I would have to scrap probably some pieces anyway. So, but remember I was explaining to you that the theta term is actually a theta angle. So there is a symmetry. Exact symmetry in this theory when theta goes to theta plus to pi. So if you ask what does that symmetry correspond to in the language of tau, so this is the symmetry in which tau goes to tau plus one. So this is also an element. So it turns out that if we do this symmetry transformation, what will happen is that NE and NM will go into NE plus NM. Magnetic charge will stay unchanged. So the Witten effect, is a special case. If you wish, this is a special case of the Witten effect, when I rotate a theta angle by 2 pi. Then I'm just shifting the charge. So I started as theta angle was equal to 0. If I change the theta angle by 2 pi, the charges of dion will shift. And so this shift is precisely the Witten effect for the shift of dion's charges. This is Witten effect. So the reason why I'm talking so much about this is because it's actually these aspects, both of them, monopoles and this statement, is crucial for the whole purpose of solving cyber Witten theory. So abstractly, we can ask, okay, so this interesting transformation, which is exact symmetry of the theory, which acts in this way on the coupling, what group does it form? So this is a group generated by these two transformations. So it turns out that S and T, those two generators, they generate a group which is SL to Z. So they generate an SL to Z. And so SL to Z, so if I act with a combination, which means that if I act with S and G, well, I can act, each of them is a symmetry. So I can act something like this, right? You know, whatever the arbitrary combination of them, and that will actually span the whole SL to Z group. And so SL to Z, so if I can think of SL to Z as an A, B, C, D, so that's an element of SL to Z, where those guys are integers, A, B, C, D are integers, and the determinant of this matrix, A, B, C, D, equals to 1. And so under an element of SL to Z, my tau goes to A tau plus B over C tau plus D. Okay, so that's how, if you give me an arbitrary element of SL to Z, I can give you a sequence of these elementary transformations, and the ultimate result will be that my tau will transform in this way, and there will be a similar transformation on the spectrum of electric and magnetic states. All right, guys, so we have all the necessary ingredients to solve the cyber-Witten model, except that I cannot, in 5 minutes, explain how we solve it. So I'm just going to give you some general pictures, and maybe I will explain how to resolve one puzzle. Okay. So the observation that Zyberg and Witten did was actually very natural. So they said, well, we know that there are Hooke polycomb monopoles, and so we should expect that there will be similar monopoles as well, right? And we can ask the question. So remember, I was telling you that low energy effective action breaks down if you emit some massless states, right? So if we look at the formula, classically, right? So classically, tau was equal to tau naught plus. Suppose I just look, forget about instant bump corrections, and just look at this term. Ln lambda to the fourth over u squared, right? So what will happen? This is k over 2 pi plus 4 pi I over g squared. So what will happen if we go, remember that plus where I use some front corrections here. So there was this u plane, and so as long as we stay from this bad region, which is a size, roughly a size of lambda squared, from the origin of the moduli space, then we are safe. And the whole problem, the problems with unitarity and the problems with being unable to leave moduli space in the right way, associated if we try to, for example, start at infinity and go inside this forbidden region, we should still be able to do it. There are still vectors there, except that those vectors we cannot understand semi-classically. But let's see what will happen. So if we go in there, what happens with this tau? So precisely, for example, at the boundary, the log would be equal to 1, okay? Because the log will be equal to 1, then the imaginary part, the log of 1 would be equal to 0, right? And so the imaginary part will vanish. So there will be a point as I move along my line, somewhere from infinity to inside this forbidden region, my g squared will be infinitely large. So I will hit a point. Again, this argument is not valid because I am outside the regime of validity, but blah, blah, blah. But let's get the intuition what is going on. So if I use this formula, then the gauge coupling will get infinitely strong. But then if the gauge coupling is infinitely strong, if I look at the mass of the magnetic monopole, the monopole mass, which is given by the expression absolute value of U to the 1/2 the charge of this magnetic monopole divided by G, right? And so you can see that no matter precisely at that point, all these magnetic monopoles will become masses. So the intuition that tells us, so we understood that we were missing something in the solution of this cyber-convicting model, and what we are missing, again, there are hints of that even in the description, which is outside the forbidden region, is that we expect that there will be light magnetically charged objects. Okay? And because they become light, in fact, we argue that they can be massless, we cannot exclude them from low energy effective action. So low energy effective action likely misses massless. Misses massless magnetically charged state. So massless, it's not that those states are massless everywhere, right? It's much like when you do a Higgs mechanism, the mass of the W boson, it actually depends where on the modular space you are. So your W bosons are massive everywhere except at the origin. So the same thing happens with this additional monopole states, right? So those are the states which are massive. In fact, if we are weak coupling, if coupling is very weak, they are infinitely heavy. They're very heavy, and so we can safely ignore them. However, they become light as we go into the forbidden region on the moduli space, and so we must include them in our low energy effective action. So I ran out of the time. So what I can do.
Cookies come out at 3.
Sorry?
Cookies come out at 3, so we have.
So thank you very much, guys, for the course. So I will continue talking until there are at least a couple people left. But at this time, so if you have your homework, please give it to me. Those of you who want one extra day really, really bad, so you can have that one extra day and give it to me, put it in my mailbox tomorrow after wine and cheese. I'll get everything that's in my mailbox. Now, as far as marking will concern, I will mark all of this, and I will give it back to Leanne. Okay, so I should do it within. Thank you. So I'm gonna do this within some reasonable next couple days. Those of you guys who are locally here, I will ask Leanne to contact you and tell that she has your homework and she can get it. Those of you guys who are not here, she can send it. So if you need it, she will send an email that the homework has been marked. They'll tell whatever mark you got in the course. And if you need the homework back, just tell her how you can get it. All right, having said that, I will continue with a couple more pages until at least what I wanted to say. Okay. All right, guys, so what I want to do first, I want to show that I think we will be kicked out, but then we will kick us out. So I'm going to continue, show first that we can resolve the first part. Okay? Let's see whether I have the left. No, I don't. So remember the problem that we had was in our low energy effective action, there was this superpotential that was corresponding to breaking n equal 2 to n equal 1. And the problem there was when you look at the F term equations of motion, right? So del W over del U, so this was the F term equations of motion, so that was equal to M, so they are not zero. So every point on the Coulomb branch was leakage. Okay? So every point on Coulomb branch. Okay, I didn't use the word Coulomb branch. So every point on the moduli space, got lifted. Let me ask if you have some seminar, we can go into the other smoking. All right, so there is not a single point that is left, and that contradicts counting how many vacua we have. And so what Simon van Witten said, well, let's suppose that there is a monopole that becomes massless somewhere. So suppose there is a point U naught. Okay, so there is some point somewhere inside here. And so at this point, we have a massless monopole. So I will denote M do I need to have a monopole? No, I actually don't want to have a monopole. Let's suppose that I have a state and it has electric charge, right? So eventually we will specify more precisely what I mean by positive charges here. So I have a state of charge plus one and it becomes massive. So it's massive everywhere except at the single point. So the thing is that I cannot introduce a single charge plus one in my theory. The reason is that I will violate anomalies. Remember that one of the anomaly cancellation conditions, sum of all charges must be equal to zero. Before, we did not have any problems with anomalies because we never had charged states. But now I am saying that, well, we have these dions and monopoles and they carry charges. And the point is that I cannot introduce a single one of them because then I will violate this anomaly cancellation condition. And so what I need to do, I actually need to, if I'm introducing something, I need to introduce pairs of them that carry opposite charges. Okay? It turns out that this argument can be refined in this particular context also with respect to magnetic charges. So monopole or dion, the same argument works. I have to introduce them as a pair. So the statement is that, suppose more precise statement is that somewhere in the forbidden regions there is a point on which my monopole and dion become masses. So then the argument goes as follows. So if If my point U is not equal to U naught, then my effective potential is precisely what we had before. And so for U is not equal to U naught, so our N equal to vacuum is lived, okay? So everywhere before we had the vacuum, before we did the deformation, after we did this deformation, there is no more vacuum, right? We cannot solve the F-term equations of motion. So, but the situation changes exactly near this U. So we need to model how will it change? Well, our superpotential, effective potential, well, first it will have the same piece as before. We cannot get rid of it. But then now we are saying that there are these massless states, and those states become massless. Those states will become massless precisely when U equals U naught. So I can introduce a trunk of this type. Okay? So notice that the combination that I wrote is neutral under U1. So it's a gauge invariant interaction. And so I'm writing down what they are expected. So now I included these light states. And so this is the way how my superpotential would look like near U0, right? So up to quadratic order. So now I have this charged state, and so I need to reanalyze my vacua, including this additional term. And so there will be D terms. So D terms, so the states are of opposite charge, and so if we write down the D term condition, the D term condition simply tells that M tilde absolute value equals to M. So again, M tilde and M are chiral superfields. Okay. That's the D term equations, and now we look at the F term equations. So as far as the F term equation is concerned, well, there is one equation, del W, which is M plus M minus U naught M tilde M, right? And then there are conditions I take the derivative with respect to U, right? So this is M, and this gives me and then the other ones, so this give me U minus U naught, and then M tilde, and then del W over del N tilde equals U minus U naught. Okay? And so notice what happens now is that we can actually solve all these equations precisely when U equals U zero as well, and there will be exactly a vacuum. So it is the point that we said, let's suppose there is a point where there is a pair of some charged states, and that pair become massless at that point, electrically or magnetically charged states. And so what we see here is that we can solve all the equations, right? And the interesting fact is that what will happen at that point is that our massless field will develop an expectation value, right? So those two guys are the same. So the absolute value of M is going to be equal to whatever the absolute value of little m to the power 1/2. So they will develop a value that big a value. So in fact, if we now go ahead and say that it is a pair of monopole monopole and anti-monopole, two monopole chiral superfields with Chagas plus and minus one that become massless, then it looks like that after the deformation, there will be a web. These fields will develop a web. And that fits nicely with the idea what the confinement is. So confinement of electric charges, the dual description of the confinement of electric charges is the Higgs mechanism in the magnetic sector. And the Higgs mechanism is the statement that our magnetic states develop a web. And that's exactly what it looks like will happen if we say that the states that become massless are precisely the monopole states. So for now, we see that we can resolve one piece of the puzzle if we say that there are additional states in the theory, and those states are massless somewhere on the modular space. It turns out that precisely at that point, will survive the deformation, and all the other vacuum will go away. So that gives us a next statement. I told you that we know the Ricker index for this model, and the Ricker index is 2. So that tells us that there should be 2. We want to have only 2 vacua left. So that suggests there should be 2 different points, 2 different special points where some states become masses. Okay. So in other words, from the physics, we know how n equals 2 supersymmetry is broken to n equals 1. We expect that there will be 2 special points on this modular space, and there will be some extra massless states at those points. And it is those states, those vacuums, that will survive their partial supersymmetry phase. All right, okay. So let's continue. So that's the first piece. So second piece, we actually will be able. So what I'm going to do, I cannot explain you, because if I have to explain you there, I don't know, I'm sure I would have to explain elliptic curves, right? So most of you probably never heard about elliptic curves and complex structures. I want to explain you how you actually, so at this stage we know that there are 2 singularities, but what are the states that become masses? So this is what I want to explain. So I want to explain you at least all the physics, and then just give you a reference to something, how you can go ahead, and then it will be purely a mathematical problem. Once we understand physics, then it will be a purely mathematical problem, and we need actually more sophisticated machinery to solve it, but it's not complicated. It's actually the easiest part in Cyber-Quitin paper. The original Cyber-Quitin paper, this mass stuff, is the simplest one. So we go back actually to your question about what do I mean exactly by being a holomorphic in the presence of logarithms? And the answer to the question is that they are not holomorphic, right? So they have monoderms. So what I'm going to tell you, about monodromies, and more precisely, holomorphicity. So we go as bad as just plain complex analysis. So suppose I have a plane. So I have a complex plane Z. So on this complex plane Z, I have a function. So I have a function f of z. So it's a holomorphic function in the sense that del f over del z bar equals 0. This is a function only of z. And moreover, I give you specifically what that function is. So this function is a square root of z. So how do I define this function? Well, this function is not actually well defined, right? It's not a single valued function. Well, if we are too strict, it's not a holomorphic function. However, I can make this function holomorphic. Okay, so I can make this function holomorphic by introducing a cut on the plane. Okay, so if I introduce a cartonic plane that goes from the origin to infinity, then the idea of analytical continuation and the idea of holomorphicity is that you give me the value of the function somewhere on the plane, and then I can do analytical continuation to any other point on the plane. And the rules are, if I have a cut, I cannot cross the cut. If I cross the cut, I will get on the other sheet of the holomorphic function. Okay? So, simply speaking, it's no longer a function, it's a section of whatever holomorphic line was. This is just work. But let's look at this simple problem, and let's actually do something that we are not allowed. So let's suppose that we actually start here. You can think of that we start when z equals to 1, right? So our function f of z, f when z equals to 1, equals 1. And then we do what we are not allowed to do. We actually, if I make a loop and the loop, there is no singularity inside the loop, right? Then I can do an analytical continuation, and so I'm going to call this loop gamma naught. So if I make this loop, then gamma naught acted on F will give me back F, right? Whatever value, so if I start with the value and I make some small loop, and as long as this loop does not circle around the singularity, then I can use properties of analytical continuation, and my function doesn't change, okay? It's a single value function. However, if it just so happens that I make this loop, okay? If I make a loop that goes around the singularity is inside the loop, then my function changes. So if I call this gamma s, so for a loop that circles the singularity, you can see that what happens with my function, so that will actually flip the sign. Sorry, the function will flip the sign. F will go to minus F. So what we have an example of monodromies, right? Monodromies mean that we look at the phi1 elements on the plane with singularities, and we look at non-trivial loops. And so what we find is that the loops and non-trivial elements of a phi1, so we choose a base point, which is the point of our interest. And so if it is a non-trivial element, then there is a transformation. In this case, f goes to minus f. So this is, if we have a function, so this type of singularity is a branch. It's a branch point. And it's actually a branch point of finite order, because if I make a loop twice, right, if I add gamma s squared, I will get back to the function, right? So in this sense, if I ask what my function really is, thinking of it as a holomorphic function, it's a two-valued function. So there are two sheets. I have to think of this as there are. So what you have to imagine that as you cross the cut, you actually end up on the second sheet of this holomorphic function. Now, if our function is slightly more complicated, something like LNZ, something that's relevant to our example, then I can still start discussion in the same manner by saying that I can make a function holomorphic by introducing a cut that jumps from 0 to infinity. But now things are more complicated, because now if I choose my base point here, and I look for loops, around the singularity, loops that cross me the cut. Well, the easiest thing is, for example, to choose z goes to z 2 pi r, that each is a 2 pi r, right? So I made a 2 pi rotation. So you can see what will happen with ln. Ln z go to ln z plus 2 pi r. Now, if I make n loops, what will happen? So if I make a loop of the singularity, in this case, there is a constant shift. There is a constant shift here. However, if I take this singular loop and I raise it to the nth power, then what will happen is that f goes to f plus 2 pi I n. So it's infinitely many. Yeah.
Isn't it finite?
Sorry?
Isn't it finite because f is first?
In the first one, it's pi I, right? Because it's a square root, and pi I is minus 1.
Yeah.
But if we do it twice, then it will be closer. Yeah.
But you will turn commands.
Sorry? No. Here my loop is the same, right? So my loop is z goes to z to pi I. I made it 2 pi rotation. So z is a complex number. It has a face. And that's a shift of the face.
Yes.
So now I'm saying that if z goes to z plus pi I, ln z goes to ln of z times e to the 2 pi
r. Sorry, I mixed up. So f is not ln z.
Now f is ln.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm looking. Yeah. So it's a different function.
Right.
Yeah. So this f is ln z. Right. So what I'm telling you is that there are different monodromes. And some of the monodromes are actually finite order. So if I think of this as an element of the group, then this is an element of the group which squares to identity in the first case. In the second case, so in this case, the monodromy around zero, right? The monodromy around zero is an element. If I think of this as an abstract group element, it's such that n squared equals to one. So in this case, there is M0 is what's known as a free generate. Okay, it doesn't have any constraints. It's a free generator. So I can take any power of this M0, and it never closes on anything nice. Okay. One more thing that I want to discuss. Again, this is just from complex analysis. So here I'm talking about a plane, complex plane. But in fact, the way how I want to think about this is actually a compactified plane. Okay. So thinking in terms of informal structures. So it's a complex plane. So I can always make a change of variables, a holomorphic change of variables, where infinity will be a finite number. So now if I think of this, so the proper way of thinking of that, is as a sphere, right? And so this is an infinity at my sphere. And so you can see that actually, if I have a singularity here, the cut goes to infinity. So I have one singularity at say zero, and so I have a cut now on the sphere. And so my monodromes, the ones that I was talking about, if I have non-trivial loops around zero, I can think of them as being a non-trivial loops around infinity. And so all these, so if I have, right, so in order for me to make a holomorphic function, right, I need to make a cut. Cut always runs with respect in between the singularity. And I can think of monodromy with a different sign. So as far as infinity concerns, there will be a different sign. So here, I would have to rotate. Again, the usual convention is that we have to go counterclockwise around the singularity. Okay, so now let's go back finally to Cypher-Convicted solution. So we understood that there are these two singularities, but actually it's more than that. So now we see that there are three singularities. There is no three singularities. There is only two singularities. So the infinity is also a special point. So there was there are these two additional singularities. So if I think about my U plane, so my U plane has a singularity at infinity, and then there are two additional singularities. Now I can use a change of variables in such a way that I can always map this guy to be at zero and this guy to be 1. So this is just changing a different coordinate on the moduli space, right? So we choose U, but we discussed briefly that U is Mach eigenvariable object that I can pretty much do anything I want, right? As long as it is a holomorphic function. So there are three singularities in this moduli space, that's what we expect. And so what we do now, we know, and on this here, we have a definition of tau of U, right? So our low energy effective action is a holomorphic function, except that it's not really a function. We understand that whenever there are singularities, it is actually, it can be multi-valued, so it's a section of a holomorphic line bundle. And so what we do know, an expansion for this function around infinity, right? Because U being infinity means that we do a Higgs mechanism at very high energy, and so we trust our perturbative expansion. So, and in this patch, this is a patch that I shaded, that's when we write out this expansion, tau classical, tau of 9 plus 1 over 2 pi I, ln over U squared, and then plus sum over instanton corrections. C1, and then I have lambda to the fourth over U squared to power n. So this expansion has, well, first of all, we already know what the radius of convergence is. As in any analytic function, the radius of convergence of that series would be the distance to one of the singularities. Yeah, actually, in the notations that I'm using, if I have lambda there, it turns out that ultimately the singularity will be at minus lambda squared and plus lambda squared. It doesn't matter. So again, this is a statement that I can choose a different coordinate system. So there is not much physics there anymore. The things that I want to do now, we're going to study the monodromes. It turns out that once we figure out what are the monodromes of the section, then we can find completely the bundle. So we can solve it. Turns out that the problem, so once we figure out what the monodromes of this tau of U are around the singularities, then the problem becomes mathematical and we can solve it. We can find an exact solution. And that's pretty much what Simon and Witten did. So let's try to follow their step. So the first thing they did, they said that, well, let's look. What if we make a loop around infinity, right? making a loop of this type. Do I have the right orientation? No, I have to run in the opposite direction. Okay. Because then, if I run this in the opposite direction, then I am circling minus. And I'm circling it this way. Okay, so we can actually see. So we are within the radius of convergence. So we make this loop. So this guy goes back to itself, right? So we have an integer power. So everything is nice. And so U goes to U to the 2 pi i for large values. So each term here goes e to the minus 4 pi I n. So e to the minus 4 pi I n. Now notice something that we talked with you, that it will go back if we have a fractional instantons. So if we have instantons or non-perturbative correction, not with the integer, but half an integer, it will not be so for. So these are, if you wish, integer instantons correction. Integer instantons. So for fractional instantons. So fractional instantons, there will be an expansion of this type, lambda to the fourth, lambda squared over u to the power n. And so the fractional instantons will still not produce any u monodromes at infinity. That's why. So there is nothing. If I make a loop, then this function go back to itself, and the only difference comes from this logarithm, right? And so if you use the algebra, you will find out that as a result of this huge loop, tau of u goes to tau of u minus 2. Now, tau of u goes to tau minus 2 is just in terms of electromagnetic duality, what happens is that we acted on our theory with the inverse T element twice, right? T element was the one that was, so remember that T was shifting tau goes to plus 1. So it wasn't doing anything, it was an exact symmetry of the theory. And so what we are saying here is that the reason why the physics doesn't change is because once we make this huge loop, what we end up doing, we just end up doing electromagnetic duality on our low energy effective field theory. Okay? And so as an element, so if I think of this as a monodromy matrix, right? So we understand that that is an element of SL to Z duality. And so I must be able to write it down as a 2x2 matrix with an integer coefficient. And indeed, I can do that if I find the right page. So, you can read it all from here. So it's minus 1, 2, 0, and minus 1. Now, you have to remember this formula that tau goes to tau A plus B over tau C plus D. And you substitute these elements of the matrix, this A, B, C, D, and you find out. So strictly speaking, all we can determine is that this element, this monodromy is up to plus or minus, right? So if you change the sign, if I flip all signs, A, B, C, and D, I will get the same transformation. So I cannot fix sign by looking at the monodromes. And so we need to do something, something more precise. And if you do something more precise, just looking at the how the charges in your theory transform, then that's exactly what's the transformation. Suppose now what you do, so here we just follow the coupling, but with each value there are states. If you say there are monopole and ion states, and how does those states will transform, then that will fix you into this element. Now, coming back to the states. So remember, I told you that the G duality is just the Witten effect, right? How does the charges of dions change if I switch the theta angle by 2 pi? And so what we have here is a monodromy around infinity. So the solvent is monodromy about infinity, about u equal infinity, is equivalent to a Witten effect on a bionic spectrum. Okay? So, good. So, any questions for now? Now we go to the fun stuff. Now we're going to find out monodromes around those two. I will tell you how Cyberhand we can do that. So, let's go back to our pitch. There was a strong coupling scale lambda, so this is our SC2 coupling. And then if we say at some point Q, right, then at that point there is a Higgsing of the SU2. So the SU2 would be in T3U1. And then my coupling is constant. Okay. So my coupling is constant, and remember I asked you what will happen, and so you gave me the answer, which was not right in that function. But you were way too smart, so you actually gave the right answer, okay, in an interesting example. So this thing will happen as long as u is not equal to u naught. Okay, as long as we are not sitting in one of these special points, then that's indeed what will happen. The coupling will stay finite. However, if we sit in one of these special points, I'm going to call this u singular, right? Then what will happen is that we have charged states, and then they are masses. And so what will happen is that this U1 coupling is no longer a constant, but it will run. And it will run exactly as we expect. So we can ask. So the leading behavior is one loop running. U2 massless. States at singularity. Right. In fact, we can just use our one loop computations and we can ask the question. So now this will be tau. It's the same tau that we have. Well, so strictly speaking, let me put a tilde. I will explain in a second why I put tilde. Okay. So suppose this running. Suppose I would have, this is a running. If I have a massless state of charge and E, okay, then my coupling will run to zero. So I can ask the question: What is my coupling near the point? And I can do a one loop computation. Okay, so this is a completely perturbative computation. I'm just going to write down the answer. So it turns out that if at this point the singularity is due to a massless chiral supercube of charge and in tilde, then near that singularity I have n in tilde over pi I. And then I have ln u minus u naught. So this is a one loop result. So there is a logarithm there. And then there are corrections, and corrections are analytic as u goes to zero. So which means that the monodromes in the coupling, a non-trivial way is how my coupling will transform around the singularity are determined. Determined by this term, determines monodromy. Okay, so it's determined by this thing. And we can actually ask the question, so exactly what my monodromy will be in this case. Well, the answer is straightforward to compute, right? So if I have a state, of charge ME, and it's massless, so it's massless at some u naught. So what I have to do, I have to make a small loop around it. So I'm going to say that my u equals u naught plus epsilon e to the 2 pi i, right? So I make a loop 2 pi i phi. And I start phi from zero, and I end up with 2 pi. So if we do that, because in fact from zero to one. Yeah. So there is one page left, guys. And then we're done. At least that's where I want to stop, because
after that it becomes mathematical. Right, so if we do that, then you can see that outbuilder will go to outbuilder plus 2 n e squared. Okay, so it's just it is a trivial computation, so log will give you 2 pi I, and so you will get pick up to the outbuilder. And so the monodromy around this point, around u naught, will be given by this matrix. 20 tilde 0 and 1. Okay? So this was easy. But then Seiberg and Witten realized the following thing. They have been able to answer the question. So here you have a state on this chart, right? So now we have states which are electric, can have electric and magnetic charge. And so this state is massless. Is massless at u naught, right? And so we know what the monodromy is in that case. Is the state carries this charge? But then they ask the question in general. So suppose I have a state ne and nm. So if I have a diode and it is a state which is electric and magnetic, and it will become massless. So is massless. So what do we do next? Okay, what do we do then? Well, the problem is that we cannot use formula like that because that formula is only for electric states, and we don't really know how to deal, how to generalize it. And so luckily there is a solution to this problem. So what they said, well, but our theory has exact electromagnetic duality. Right. So even though I don't know what the monodromy will be or how my coupling will behave when this state is massless. So what I can do, the duality group is SL to Z, and under the duality group, what happens is that an electric and magnetic will go into ABCD. And electric and magnetic, so the charge is transformed in a non-trivial way. So what I can do, I have tau and the massless state, right, in my theory, but I can always find out the SL to Z transformation in such a way that this state, I find 2 by 2 matrix, which is SL to Z, which becomes a state of this type. And then it will be tau tilde, e tilde, n tilde, and 0, right? So there will be some element n of SL to Z, right? In such a way that it will convert me magnetically charged state into the state that carries only electric charges. But once I have electric charges, I know what my coupling is. And so I know what my monodromy is. So I can compute monodromy here and then go back using the inverse element. Okay? So this is the rough set of ideas. They cheated by saying that we're going to do what we know how to do, and then we go back. And what we're doing is completely legal because the theory has an exact electromagnetic duality, and so it's an exact symmetry. So if you do this exercise, going to n, finding the appropriate n and doing that backward, then you will find out that in general, this matrix gets slightly more complicated, and it takes the following form. 1 plus 2 n electric and magnetic minus 2 m squared, and then here 2 n electric squared, 1 minus 2, n electric, and magnetic. So they said, okay, well, very well. So now we know if the state with electric and magnetic charges is massless, then we know what monodromy is. So what they said now, so there are two singularities. Suppose that here is electric charge 1, magnetic charge 1. Here is electric charge 2.
and magnetic charge too, okay, we don't know what it is. But then there is a monodrone. I'm going to call this M2, and I'm going to call this M1. And we know an explicit expression of this as 2x2 matrices. The only thing is that I need to substitute a different pair of integers. But what they did, they observed the following fact, which is actually a statement in the phi 1 of this function plane. So so this M infinity, right? So M infinity equals to M1 and M2. Right? I can think that instead of doing a loop around infinity, I can do a loop around M1 and then a loop around M2, and it will be exactly the same as a loop around infinity. So there is a constraint, right? That M infinity, we know explicitly what M infinity is, and we know M1 and M2 as 2x2 matrices in terms of given in terms of integers. So we have an algebraic equations to solve, and it turns out that this algebraic equation has unique solutions. Actually, not unique solutions, but unique physical solutions. So let me give you the answers. So it turns out that the solution that satisfies that condition, you simply multiply two matrices with N1 and N2s and equate them to an infinity. And so what you will find out that N electric 1 and magnetic 1 are equals plus or minus N comma 1, where N is any integer, and N electric 2 and N magnetic 2 equals plus or minus N minus 1 and 1. Well, as always, you need a pair of the singularity, a charge and its opposite must become masses. But actually, the statement is that this M is unphysical, because by Wickham effect, if I start with a state 0, 1, and I do a Wickham effect, right, a rotation, theta goes to theta plus 2 pi, this state will go into this state. So all these states, so these are the states, they are all equivalent, right? So they are all equivalent just to the states 0, 1, minus 1, and 1. Okay? So the bottom line is that requirement that we have consistent description of supersymmetry breaking led us to the picture that there must be two singularities. We figured that what those monodromes are. And we actually, so we see that physically what this means is that there is a monopole. So this is a unit charge monopole that becomes massless. Monopole, and this is a dion that becomes massless. But then after that, the problem becomes a mathematical problem. So we have an explicit monodromy. So the mathematical problem is, given as here with three holes, and you know that your function has these specific monodromes around the function, find the function. Okay? This problem has a unique solution, and that unique solution is the Seiberg-Witten solution to the problem, and it solves the other puzzle. It turns out that the solution you can rigorously prove actually does never break the unitary. So the imaginary part, if you now have this solution, so imaginary part of tau is always positive. So it never becomes negative. Now, if you can repeat all the same things, assuming that the instanton expansion is not fractional, is not integer instanton, but there are fractional instanton corrections, you can repeat all the same arguments, and you will find out that the Seiberg-Witten solution is not unique. So there is an infinite set, but countable set of Seiberg-Witten solutions. But the problem with those sets is that if I ask what the monopole condensates are, if I break the supersymmetry, I will get an infinite condensate. But that's an interesting question, whether or not there are fractional instantons in an equal to A series. The reason why it's an interesting question, because in lower supersymmetric series, there are expressions. All right, guys, so after this, if you want to look at this, so you have enough information to actually look at the original paper by Cypher and Wick. So you can read it, you should be able to understand it. That's a 94 paper, which started a lot of changes the way how we think in field theory and string theory. All right, guys, thank you very much for being good listeners, and I'll hopefully see some of you later.
You got an idea.